20th of November, the great census clock in Washington indicated that this country now numbered some 200 million citizens. Mr. Johnson presided at the celebration, and when the computer indicated that 8 zeros were now preceded by a 2, that the measure of our size had been passed, the speech was interrupted with wild applause. At least those who were present believed that a significant, hopeful landmark had been met and passed. Unfortunately, all that this applause and this celebration indicated was that we had not yet psychologically oriented ourselves to the new problems of a radically new age. When the strength of a nation was measured by its sinews, by brute force, when men were looked upon still largely as workhorses, as pack animals, when men believed that the mass of men could not be given dignity and a graceful life, then indeed the numbers of a nation were a measure of its strength. But today, when the strength of a nation lies in its skills and its trained people, when we firmly believe that all have a right to dignity and to grace in their lives, today sheer numbers are a drain on our economy, represent a threat to our ability to provide quality in education, decency in housing, adequate employment, unlimited opportunity. It took till 1915 for this nation to reach 100 million people. It required another 35 years for us to reach the 150 million mark. It required only 17 years for the 200 million mark to be passed. And many experts tell us that by the end of this century, just 33 years from now, there will be 340 or 345 billions of us. 5,000 more Americans live in this country every day than the day before. And they clog our schools, they overcrowd our housing, they inundate our cities and limit their ability to respond with adequate services. They overwhelm the landscape, threaten to destroy what remaining beauty there is naturally, openly on this continent. And of course, we are the richest and most blessed nation on the face of this earth. This human flood, that is what it is. This population explosion, which like all explosions is destructive, is not only straining our ability to provide quality, opportunity, to sustain democracy, to make the city something more than a jungle. But in other parts of the world, it is absolutely destroying their capacity to survive. There are 3.3 billion people on the face of this earth today. There are 180,000 more people on this earth every day. By the end of this century, there will be 7.3 billion people. Who will feed them? What will they be fed? Who will clothe them? How will they be housed? Who will educate them? In this country of ours, with one of the finest educational systems extant, we require one out of every two college graduates for the next 10 years simply to staff our public school classrooms. Where will the world find teachers, and doctors, and nurses, and engineers, and the bureaucrats, and the politicians, and the industrialists? Where will it find the ability to dam up this human flood, to control it, and to return the river of population to its banks? This is the problem. And already in 1967, we were beginning to pay the price for the population explosion. In Egypt, in Syria, in Venezuela, in Brazil, other such countries, the standard of living was slipping. Population was outracing and outdistancing the ability of the economy to provide. Nobody knows how many die every day of starvation in India, but during this year it became clear that sheer numbers were destroying India's ability to survive as a nation. In November, the ruling Congress party through the parliament abrogated most of the constitutional laws of India. Why? Because the population explosion had bred such misery and such poverty that in many of the outlying states, radical voices were heard demanding immediate solutions, and there were no solutions. And so the Indians voted that they could arbitrarily depose from office parliaments and elected officials who spoke the language which the government was not prepared to hear. Greece, where for a long time people had strained the food supply. In Greece, which had a measure of advancement, to be sure, far more than India, but a measure of royal repression from a foolish boy king who refused to allow the elected parliament to vote land reform and tax reform, which would have taken away the feudal privileges of his friends. In Greece, democracy was destroyed early in 1967. And strongman rule remained the rule in large parts of our globe. Because poverty and misery are bred by too many people, and poverty and misery lead to radicalism, lead to the mob, and lead those who are privileged and in control to use to the utmost authority to control the mob, to maintain their prerogatives. People, sheer numbers, threatened our world. The Chinese-Russian, the Sino-Soviet dispute was heated up during 1967. Not only were consular delegates and student visitors attacked in both countries and consular officers and embassies sacked, but troops were massed along that long Mongolian-Siberian border. For it is well to remember that the Russian-Chinese dispute is not only an argument over control of the Communist Party apparatus, but it is an argument for control of the near empty steppe lands of Inner Asia, which the Chinese see as a place to solve their agricultural problem. In the Middle East, have-not nations desperately near bankruptcy precipitated a war with Israel. In Greece, a military junta come to power precipitated near war with Turkey over Cyprus because it could not solve the domestic problems, and like the Arab states, turn the concern of the people away from anger at the government to anger at some foreign enemy. There's only one problem in our world today. Can human development, the economy, social service, education, housing, agriculture catch up with the human flood? And unfortunately, in most of our world, in most of the chanceries of the globe, it was business as usual. Old border disputes. Mr. de Gaulle was meddling with French-Canadian nationalism. He was spending France's gold reserve to develop nuclear arms. He was finding new markets for his industrialists in the Middle East by turning off France's traditional friendship with Israel. Germany wanted markets, and Germany wanted reunification. Spain wanted Gibraltar. Portugal wanted to hold on to her remaining colonies. Wherever you turned on our globe, it was business as usual, except in England. England seemed determined to take stock, to pull back from military and economic commitments she could no longer manage, to provide new forms of social service, of new economic opportunity, new development in the homeland. And the cost was frightening, symbolized by devaluation of the pound, symbolized by an austerity budget, symbolized by the pullback of her troops east of Suez, and the other nations of the world looking upon England's troubles shook their head and wanted no part of it. The world wanted its fat where there was fat, its privilege where there was privilege. Our own country wanted it. Our national budget requires $75 billion for military defense. Our national budget provides $4.8 billion for health, $4.6 billion for education, $2.9 billion for housing, model cities, air and water pollution control and the like. Now, of course, this is not the whole story. There are state and there are local programs. But when we translate down this domestic budget, this human budget, into Cleveland, what do we find? Welfare clients receive 8 to 4% of minimal subsistence, not enough to keep body and soul together. There was not a single low-cost family apartment unit completed under federal auspices in Cleveland in 1967. 7,500 4- and 5-year-olds qualify for Head Start classes. We could provide place for only 2,200 of them. And on, and on, and on. No one was prepared to accept austerity, to accept higher taxes, to pay the price of human reform, social development. We talked about it, but we did not vote it. Year-long, the Congress balked to even maintain the war on poverty at its present level. And there were weeks in November when the Office of Economic Opportunity didn't have money with which to carry on. For 6 months, the Congress made bad humor over a simple rat control bill. We talked of a great society. We built schools, and we built roads, and we rebuilt the center of some cities. But you know, for all of it, because of the human flood, it was like running in place. We're not getting ahead of the problem. And just 2 days ago, the Presidential Commission appointed to investigate the cause of the summer riots, which turned the centers of Newark and Detroit into flaming torches, reported that they would simply not release their proposals because they would require an annual expenditure of $25 billion a year, and it was patently evident that neither the president nor the Congress nor the people were prepared to assume such a burden. The world in 1967 was not yet ready to admit that it lived in 1967 and not in the early 19th or 20th century. We still assumed that it was enough to band-aid our problems, to find palliative solutions, that we could enjoy affluence unbounded and have domestic peace, and provide quality education and decent housing. We couldn't and weren't. We, whose gross national product is 20%, one-fifth of the total economic power of the world, we could not meet our problems. Imagine the magnitude of these problems worldwide. And people, the sheer mass of human birth is destructive today. Destructive of economic development, destructive of social cohesion, destructive of human values, destructive of peace. The have-nots fell further away from the haves. Partially it was their fault. Partially their leaders continued to bank their profits in Switzerland rather than to reinvest them in their own nations. This is particularly true in Latin America. Partially, they began to have the ambitions of all diplomats for power and for glory. Peru, Chile, countries in sub-Saharan Africa which could not afford sophisticated arms were buying them in quantities. There were small border disputes they wanted to adjust in their favor. And the great countries of the world, the great countries which understood the folly of the arms race because we were spending our gold for it, they stimulated Nigeria and Sierra Leone and the Congo and Chile and Peru. $15 billion worth of arms were sent by the rich nations to the underdeveloped nations, sold or lent or sold on long-term easy credits. We were in the arms sales business. During 1967, it was revealed that the Pentagon sold $1 billion of used arms a year, peddled them around the world. We talked of economic aid, but this military sales outnumbered our military aid by a factor of two. And in the Soviet Union, the military peddling of arms by the Soviet Union outdistanced its economic aid for dams and for irrigation and for fertilizer and for new cities and new plants by a figure of 50 to 1. Our nation continued in 1967 to do business as it had done in the past century. We continued to expect the problems of our cities, the problems of our people, the problems of our economy to be solved by easy, pragmatic solutions which would not cause us to tighten our belts, to make dramatic new departures, radical revolutions in our social thinking. And this was not to be. And our cities went up in flames. And more cities will go up in flames because there has been no market advance. 22.8% of the Negro youth of the United States is unemployed. 30 million Americans still have incomes of less than $3,000 a year, less than bare subsistence. And there, of course, was inflation during 1967. Inflation ate away 6% of the value, the purchasing power of the dollar in the last 18 months, 4 cents of every dollar in the last 12 months. And who was hurt? The elderly on small fixed incomes, the poor on welfare. Every dollar they earn is a dollar they must spend. Every dollar that is given to them is a dollar they must spend. Every dollar that they had was worth 96 cents by December. There was inflation. There were higher taxes. Services were costing more. A construction worker who earned $8,000 at the beginning of this year and who, by virtue of strikes or negotiations, managed a 6% wage increase during 1967, found at the end of the year, taking inflation and the new taxes and new Social Security measures into consideration, that he actually was able to pocket 30 additional dollars. The nation was balking at new taxes, balking at new welfare legislation, but the cost of delay, the hidden cost, was far higher. And this no one in America was talking about, and no one in America was demanding. It was Vietnam, of course, which precluded a real attack on poverty. It was Vietnam which preoccupied our intentions. It was Vietnam which forced that ultimate anomaly of our national policy. $32 billion to be involved in a civil war in Southeast Asia. $1.9 billion for for the war on poverty in the United States. And many who opposed the war, not only because it seemed to be the wrong war in the wrong place at the wrong time, opposed it because it represented all that was askew, all that was absolute folly in our national policy. It turned us into worldwide policemen where we couldn't police our own streets in safety. Typically, those who opposed the war, Martin Luther King in April of this year, had this to say. In saying it, he reflected the feelings of many Americans. In truth, the hopes of the Great Society had been overcome by the fears and frustrations of Vietnam. The pursuit of this widened war has narrowed domestic welfare programs, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens, both at the front and at home. The anti-poverty program is cautiously initiated, zealously supervised, and evaluated for immediate results, while billions are liberally expended for this ill-considered war. The recently revealed misestimate of the war budget amounts to $10 billion for a single year. This error alone is more than five times the amount committed to anti-poverty programs. The security we profess to seek in foreign adventures we will lose in our decaying cities. The bombs in Vietnam exploded home. They destroy the dream and possibility for a decent America. If we reversed investments and gave the armed forces the anti-poverty budget, the generals could be forgiven if they walked off the battlefield in disgust. Poverty, urban problems, and social progress generally are ignored when the guns of war become a national obsession. When it is not our security that is at stake, but questionable and vague commitments to reactionary regimes, values disintegrated to foolish and adolescent slogans. It is estimated that we spend $322,000 for each enemy we kill, while we spend in the so-called war on poverty in America only about $53 for each person classified as poor, and much of that $53 goes for salaries of people who are not poor. We have escalated the war in Vietnam and de-escalated the skirmish against poverty. It challenges the imagination to contemplate what lives we could transform if we were to cease killing. And we did not cease killing during 1967, nor did we cease having our young men killed. The cost of the war in Vietnam this year is driven home with a vengeance. By the end of 1965, we had lost 1,360 men in Vietnam killed. A year later, in December of 1966, that number had risen to 5,006. By December 31st of this year, by today, we had lost over 15,500 dead. 45,000 Allied troops had been killed. 100,000 Vietnamese casualties had fallen in this war. They said that 187,000 North Vietnamese and Viet Cong bodies had been counted in that macabre process of ours by which we assess victory. But the war was beginning to come home to roost, and its cost was rising every day. By December 1965, we had 125,000 men in Southeast Asia. By December of 1966, we had 300,000. By December of 1967, today, we have 525,000 men, over 500,000 men. And the cost, and the end, are not in sight. About a month ago, we had a rash of optimistic prophecies about the end of the war. General Westmoreland was here, and he told us optimistically that the rate of infiltration had been reduced from some 14,000 a month from the north in December of last year to 6,000 a month in December of this year. That the rate of recruitment into the Viet Cong had been reduced from 7,500 a month last year to 3,600 a month this year. that the number of South Vietnamese living under Viet Cong control had been reduced from 4 million last year to 2 million this year. But most of us were skeptical. The credibility gap had come home to roost. We too often in December and as election years began had been told optimistically of the results of the war. And there were conflicting stories coming out of Southeast Asia. Not only had we not won, not only was the kill ratio diminishing. 3 years ago, the government was claiming that we were killing 15 Viet Cong for every one Allied soldier. This year, the ratio is down to 3 to 1. Not only was it clear from the reports in Southeast Asia that the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong were better armed today than they had been 2 years ago, that the air defenses of North Vietnam were among the most sophisticated that the world had ever seen. Not only was it clear that the North Vietnamese had not yet lost their desire to fight, that Secretary McNamara had been correct in April of this year when he had said that there is no clear evidence that our bombing has or will destroy the ability or the will of the North Vietnamese to respond. And then, of course, there was the futility of the pacification program. Our inability to force the junta in Saigon to bring reforms to the nation, to reform the tax system, to reform the land, to get out of Saigon and to work with the people. It was not clear that the shadow government of the Viet Cong had not, in fact, still major control during the night hours of that benighted land. And benighted it was. Napalm, defoliants, more tonnage of bombs dropped on that godforsaken part of the world than in all of Europe by all Allied and Axis forces in the Second World War. The war went on. Its end was not in sight. 1967 had begun with the Pope and Prime Minister Wilson of England and others speaking hopefully of some kind of understanding with Hanoi, only let the United States cease its bombing. The bombing had not ceased. There was no understanding. The President, throughout the year, had spoken hopefully of negotiations, of his willingness to negotiate with anyone at any time, at any place. And he had twice had to fly to the distant places, to Guam and to Australia, to convince the freely elected, quote-unquote, leaders of South Vietnam that this is what they, in fact, had said. But there were no negotiations. And it was not clear at all what the United States was intending by this tender of negotiations. Did we mean that there would be compromise, that issues could be adjusted, that the Viet Cong, who are far more South Vietnamese, many of them, than the generals in Saigon, who are by and large North Vietnamese, that the Viet Cong would have a rightful place in some post-war coalition? General Wheeler, our chief of staff, speaking of the Detroit Economic Club just 3 weeks ago, said this. This is his definition, and perhaps ours, of negotiation. Negotiation is not a face-saving device for abandoning the objectives we have been fighting for. It is a method for achieving our objectives. We have always been and are still willing to negotiate. We are not ready to negotiate our defeat, or a face-saving withdrawal which would invalidate the sacrifice we and our allies have made. Now, this is not negotiation. This is the demand for capitulation. This is a statement that after the war, there will be a pro-Western, independent South Vietnam, just as there was not before the war began. The war drags on. Abrasive to our economy, destructive to that sense of common weal which once upon a time joined most of us in America, precipitating the most violent, vitriolic national debate in most of our lifetimes. There were many who had simply opted out from the American society. They looked on the Vietnamese War not only as morally wrong, not only as politically naive, but as a statement of a continuing preoccupation with those things which avail not, with old patterns of geopolitical policy, which in an age which requires homes, food, clothing, and education, and jobs, is simply irrelevant. We had that image throughout 1967 of bitterness, demonstration which was close to civil disobedience. We saw the extremists of both sides become more and more visible, uglier and uglier in their speech. Stokely Carmichael made a worldwide triumphant tour condemning America to those who hate America around the world, and he brought George Wallace out into the political hustings. The right and the left, the extreme right and the extreme left, were shrill during 1967, and the voices of reason, the voices that were responsible, rarely could make themselves heard. People were reacting by December of this year far more emotionally, with far less discrimination and far less judgment than they had been a year ago. A year ago, you could still talk about the possible tactics for ending the war. A year ago, you could still talk about the necessary tactics and strategy for combating poverty in the city. Today, people sneer at one group or at another, condemn one demonstration or another, and will have nothing of the issue. And that's tragic, and part of the cost of this war, which this country is bearing. There's more violence in our streets, and to a large degree it's attributable to the war. There's more disruption in our home life, and to a large degree this is attributable to the war. There is uncertainty in our economy, and to a large degree this is attributable to the war. It was the greatest gold outflow in our history, and what did it mean? Simply that banks and men around the world were gambling against the soundness of American policy. Now, there were solutions to the gold problem, but more significant than the removal of the cover on our gold supply, or simply removal of the gold supply as the guarantee of our economy, was the statement that these people were gambling against the ability of our war-swollen economy to survive, to remain stable and firm. The economy grew by a smaller percentage in 1967 than in any year in the decade. The output of our factories, despite the war, dropped from 91% of capacity to 84%. The stock market reminded one of 1928-29. Fervent speculation combined with corporate pyramiding. One wondered and one looked, and one spoke openly of the possibility of recession, and the poor and the struggling and the aged struggled with the realities of inflation. 1967 was not a good year. And 1968 dawns without a great deal of indication that we're rounding a corner. There'll be an election, but what will be the choice? American politics are obviously coming into new focus. The traditional power blocks which sustain both of the major parties are crumbling and disintegrating. But into what form, what shape are they taking? Is Wallace the thrust of the future? Is the radicalism of the left the thrust of the future? Where was the leadership, the political leadership, the statesmanship which would say to the American people, this is the time when a new start must be taken, not a new deal and not a fair deal and not the great society, but a radical new departure in social engineering and social democracy. This is the time when you must tighten your belts. We must give up this glutted society of abundance, where we must pour billions of dollars into our cities before they become devastating to us psychologically, economically, and otherwise. We must clear our air and clear our water and clear our minds of the mists of the past. Gunnar Myrdal, the great Swedish economist, estimates it will cost us $1 trillion a decade simply to fight the war on poverty. Educators tell us it will cost us $several trillion a decade simply to provide adequate education for the many. You can't vote minimal domestic budgets and solve the social problems of the day. And if you don't solve the social problems, you have violence, and you have the chaos of the city, and you have the riots of Hough, and you have the riots of Newark, and the riots of Detroit, and you have the continued anger of those young minds, those clear minds, who recognize the stupidity and the folly of an unreconstructed social order. This was our challenge as 1967 ended. We could not survive only on what we are doing today. The United Appeal was not enough. Public welfare was not enough. Minimal school budgets were not enough. Housing, the national housing programs were minimal. Age-dependent children was being cut back. Social Security was not totally adequate. There were 1,000 human needs. Every day, 10,000 Americans came to our cities, and our cities lacked the amenities and the conveniences to provide services to them. Our cities were still the cities of the 19th century, and it's going to require millions and billions of dollars to refashion so that one can live with some dignity in them in the 20th. And this is our choice, to continue as we have in the past, banking our small profits, or to continue as we, or to begin as we must do for the future, to invest the largest measure of what we earn in the society which makes life possible. It's going to mean the end of Shaker Heights and Pepper Pike as we know it. It's going to mean the end of the great American fortunes as they once were. There's going to be a desperate struggle in these days of governmental planning to preserve the freedoms which must be preserved. But the longer we delay, the more desperate that struggle will be. Longer Americans continue to be unwilling to devote the major share of their national prosperity to the preservation of their land in beauty and in opportunity. As long as we delay, so long will the future be bleak. 1968, we'll see an election. I'm afraid that in the terms of the problems as I see them, the election will again be an election which does not offer a choice. The first responsibility for this nation is to disembarrass itself of the Vietnamese War.